out here this afternoon. I thought everybody would be really excited to come and learn about integrated health partnerships. I know I am excited to learn about them because I find it very confusing, and it's really important. And so we're going to get started, and when we do get a quorum in the room, we will announce that and move the minutes. But I do want to use our time well because we have three presentations today, and they're all really important, even though they're all kind of they deal with different topics. So it's going to be kind of our catch-up day today with some of these presentations. We had had the integrated health partnerships on the agenda previously, and we weren't able to get to that. So if we could get Ms. Peterman to come to the table. Is she here? Oh, we're going to switch. Okay, I stand corrected. We are going to switch the order and start with the Department of Health, which is going to talk with us about the issue of network adequacy. So Mr. Major is here from the Department of Health, and if he would approach. So, members, while he's getting set up, I just would kind of give you a little frame about what we're talking about here, and maybe he is going to do this as well. But and I'm not sure if he's going to talk just about our public programs or about network adequacy generally, but this is a really important topic for us because we often hear from our constituents who are on public programs or even those who are on other kinds of insurance that they can't go to the doctor who's just down the street from them, that some hospital used to be in their network and it's not anymore, that they feel that they don't have access to the providers that they would like to have access to. And this comes back to the issue of networks in under health insurance of various kinds. Every health insurance product has a network. And these networks are regulated by the Department of Health. And so that is why we're doing this presentation today, just to understand a little bit about what that regulation looks like, allow members to just learn a little bit more about it, because even though this is one of those in-the-weeds topics, nobody's going to, you know, have a postcard that says, you know, Representative such-and-such was a champion for network adequacy, you know. But nevertheless, this is something that really underlies a lot of the things that people care about very deeply. So we do have a quorum now. I would – is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Was that – that was Representative Cantrell? Moves to approve the minutes of January 24th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? I'm sorry, February. Only feels like January. It says February. It says January, actually. Okay. I don't know. We got the wrong. Does everyone have the minutes of February 6th? Is that what you've got?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, good. Is there any discussion to those minutes? All right, hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Got to get these old ones out of my pack. Okay. All right, Mr. Major, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself, and please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman Liebling and members. My name is Tom Major. I'm the manager for the Managed Care Systems section at the Minnesota Department of Health. And the Managed Care Systems section is in charge with regulating health maintenance organizations that are licensed by the state of Minnesota. That's our basic function. I'm going to start by giving you a little bit of an overview of where we're situated in the department as far as regulation relative to other agencies and our work and the market in general before I dig a little bit more into provider network adequacy and the waiver process. So the managed care section licenses and regulates health maintenance organizations and also designated county-based purchasers. And the purpose of that regulation is to ensure that companies follow all applicable laws and rules governing solvency, quality of care, access to services, complaints and appeals processes for their enrollees and other consumer rights. We seek to ensure that enrollees are protected and receive the coverage and services to which they're entitled. A kind of a note about health maintenance organizations, they're kind of their structure is kind of the earmarks, the elements of being a health maintenance organization is that they provide a comprehensive range of services. They usually do this on a capitated payment basis for a fixed prepaid sum, and they generally use a defined provider network. But as we shall see, more and more other types of insurers are also using provider networks. So the Department of Health has regulatory authority over individual and small group plans and large group HMO plans in the fully insured commercial market. And I want to talk about that a little bit. The small group market is defined by employers that have 50 or fewer employees. Individual and family plans are obviously sold to individuals and families. And then the large group are with employers that are greater than 50 employees. Most of those employers are quite large, and most of them are also in the self-insured market. The department has little authority over self-insured. An example of a self-insured plan is one where most people are familiar with, the State Employee Group Insurance Program, which acts as a self-insured plan. All self-insured plans are regulated under the Employee Retirement Income and Security Act of 1974, also known as ERISA, and these plans are regulated by the Department of Labor. Additionally, we don't have any authority over Medicare plans, basically products that are offered under the aegis of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We do support the Department of Human Services in their work with managed care organizations. We regulate the HMOs and the county-based purchasers that operate as managed care organizations throughout the state, and these MCOs offer medical assistance in Minnesota care. Now, this slide is maybe familiar to some of you. It's produced by our colleagues at the Health Economics Program, and it gives you an idea of the distribution of the Minnesota healthcare market by population. And as you can see on the one side, large group in the commercial market is about 50% of that, and most of that is the self-insured plans, as I noted previously. Additionally, small group insurance and the non-group or the individual market insurance make up approximately 9% of the market. And then on the right side of the chart, you'll see both the medical assistance and Minnesota care offering about 17% of the market and Medicare at 17% of the market as well. And as of 2016, we had an uninsured rate of a little bit over 5.3%. So I want to talk to you a little bit about provider network adequacy and what it is. The managed care system section reviews healthcare provided provider networks marketed by health plans and insurers in the individual and small group market to ensure access for enrollees. Network adequacy essentially describes the access that a consumer has to get a sufficient number of providers and the proximity of those providers to the consumer, that is, how far away or how close that provider is. And the facilities, and whether this is sufficient to meet the healthcare needs of all the insurers, members, or the enrollees in a timely manner. We review these systems annually as part of the individual and small group market review under Chapter 62K. We also review provider networks offered by HMOs. So this slide shows the overall framework for network adequacy. There are federal laws that apply as well as state laws. Federal regulation requires that insurers offer a qualified health plans that offer a provider network that is sufficient in numbers and types of providers, including essential community providers, so that all services are accessible without reasonable delay. Similarly, Minnesota law also applies similar provisions. It requires that provider networks include a sufficient number and type of providers, including providers that specialize in mental health and substance use disorder services, to ensure covered services are available to all enrollees without unreasonable delay. And I wanted to point out two terms here, we use qualified health plans. And qualified health plans are defined under the Affordable Care Act. They, a qualified health plan must include all the essential health benefits defined under ACA, and they have cost-sharing limitations. And then additionally, an essential community provider, an ECP, and in Minnesota they're designated by the Department of Health, is a health care provider that serves high-risk, special needs, and underserved individuals. And health plans must be sure to contract with provider to all designated ECPs in their service areas. So on this slide, we get to the specific standards for provider network adequacy. So there's both a 30-mile and a 60-mile geographic access standard that apply to provider networks offered through health plans offered in the individual and small group markets. And the 30-mile standards apply to primary care providers, both adult and pediatric primary care, mental health providers, and general hospitals. There's an additional 60-mile standard that applies to a range of specialty providers and ancillary services. And there's some examples of those types of providers there. On this slide, I'd like to address the network adequacy waivers. So it's possible that a health plan, in fact, it's quite frequent, a health plan submits a provider network and they cannot meet the geographic access standard in all parts of their service area. Under state statute, an insurer may apply to the Commissioner of Health to receive a waiver if they can't meet the 30 or 60 mile standard for a specific provider type in a specific county. The department has reviewed waivers addressing the following situations. First, the first situation is when there are no providers of a given type in a particular part of a service area or the county that meets the geographic access standard. And this is often due to a variety of reasons, some having to do with population and where development has happened, where economies emerge. The healthcare system, healthcare systems and providers tend to follow populations. So in greater Minnesota, where there's less less populous and it's not as dense, there are fewer providers, and particularly there are fewer specialists that can meet standards. Additionally, a topography will come into play, and that affects the location of providers. So you might think about large lakes, the boundary waters, tribal lands, and mountain ranges. These will all affect the location of where providers practice, and consequently their geographic location relative to a service area. About 81% of the waivers that the department reviews and approves are based on this reason. Sometimes there are also providers who may be available in a particular part of a service area, but they just don't meet the credentialing standards of the health plan. And the credentialing standards are nationally set. This is a pretty rare situation. Most providers need to seek to continue to practice under credentialing standards or else they're out of business pretty quickly. Sometimes a health plan and provider will attempt to negotiate a contract, so they will offer the contract to available providers, or a provider will seek out a contract and they'll enter negotiations. But for whatever reason, sometimes costs, sometimes the other terms of the contract, they cannot come to terms. So that's a third reason which a waiver may be granted. And finally, we've come to recognize another situation where carriers have applied for waivers. And these are generally where there have been exclusive contracts with certain provider systems, often to create what's called an accountable care organization model. And sometimes the health plan has created a narrow network in order to control premium costs. The department requires that waiver requests fully state the reasons that the geographic access standard cannot be met and the steps the carrier has taken and will take to meet the access standard going forward. And we ask that all health plans provide clear descriptions of how access will be provided for the specific services identified. This is a key part of our review every year of the network adequacy waivers. So I wanted to note that the total number of waivers issued, and bear with me as I walk a little bit through some math here, the total number of waivers issued for 2019 was 4,985. Now, A waiver is a very specific thing. It applies to a specific provider type in a specific county and for a particular network. So there are 35 provider types in 87 counties and 44 networks that were reviewed. So the potential, if a waiver was applied for every single situation, would be that there are 133,980 waivers. But as you'll see in a second, the total number of waivers granted is a smaller, much smaller percentage of that total possible number of waivers. So on this slide, you'll see a comparison table of waivers granted in 2018 and 2019 on the left side, and then a regional map where waivers were granted on the right side. These numbers include all the waivers that were granted in the individual and small group markets for networks offered both on and off of MNsure. As you can see in the chart on the left, the total number of potential waivers is rather large because each waiver is very specific. As I noted, they're for a particular provider type in a county and in a network. For the past 2 years, the total number of waivers issued annually has been about 4% of the potential number of waivers that could be granted. For 2019, 68% of our waivers were granted for small group networks, and 32% of our waivers were granted for individual market networks. And that actually represents roughly the number of networks that we reviewed and approved. About two-thirds of our networks are small group market networks, and then the smaller one-third portion is the individual market networks. As you can see from the map on the right side, greatest number of waivers were granted in greater Minnesota, specifically northeast, northwest, and southwest Minnesota. And comparatively, in the metropolitan area, there's going to be no or very few waivers. There were eight counties in 2019 that for which no waivers were requested, and those counties are Chisago, Goodhue, Hennepin, Passante, Mille Lacs, Ramsey, Rice, and Washington. To add another layer to what we can share with you on waivers today, we wanted to look at the mental health waivers that were applied for and reviewed by the department. So again, we have a comparison slide of waivers granted in 2018 and 2019. And on that top line, you see the total number of waivers issued for all provider types, and then the number of waivers issued for mental health providers. So the number of waivers issued for mental health providers represent about 3% in both 2018 and 2019 of the total number of waivers offered. Just to note, mental health providers include psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, licensed clinical social workers. There are other provider types that are included in this category. Like waivers all overall, the majority of provider mental health provider waivers were issued for a small group market, and that just follows the trend of how many small group market networks there are. They were primarily issued for the first reason that I explained to you. There's simply no providers available in parts of the state, and that's consistent also with the overall trends in provider network waivers. The chart on the right breaks down where those waivers were issued by county. So these were all the counties in which waivers for mental health providers were issued. It looks like there were 15 counties issued provider network waivers in 2018 for mental health providers and 13 in 2019. So overall, I would note that the Minnesota Department of Health reviewed networks for individual and small group plans to be offered in 2019. 12 of those plans were individual and family qualified health plan networks offered on MNsure and through the exchange. 14 were individual and family plan networks offered off of the exchange. And I want to note there's some overlap here. Some of those networks are offered both on the exchange and off the exchange. So if you're counting up total number of networks, which is 44, it's not going to match exactly. 17 small group qualified health plans were also offered, and these are all being offered outside of MNsure. I would say overall, the department continues to look at a number of issues as we look at provider networks offered through the state. Much of this is systemic. We're continuing to look at where workforce is available and the general distribution of providers, and all this affects access and the ability of the provider networks to meet standards. This is clearly the biggest challenge that we have in providing access and ensuring access to these networks. Additionally, we're looking at network structures, and we know that there are a number of, I guess more generally, and I use the term advisedly, more narrow networks. It's more frequently a model, and it's one of the models that is being offered out there to basically balance a premium price point and providing access throughout the state. And we continue to be concerned about making sure that there's access to particular sets of providers, and mental health providers are one of those. Thank you for your time this afternoon, and I'm glad to take any questions you may have at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Major. And we do have members who want to ask questions. I have Haley, Kunish-Padin, and Loeffler. So, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. You highlight mental health providers mm-hmm. and the waivers, but can you also speak to reasons, or is there some specific areas in outstate Minnesota and why we're seeing the number of waivers that are needed mm-hmm. in rural Minnesota?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Major.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Representative Haley.
Are there certain either providers needed, or is it due to distance or topography? So what are the general reasons for, I think I know some of the answers,
right.
but I would like it illuminated,
right.
The challenges that outstate Minnesota is facing.
Mr. Major.
Madam Chair and Representative. So I think, again, I would point to some of the system issues and providers following where populations develop. And I know I can get some numbers to you about specific providers and which ones are more likely to need a waiver. But among those are the specialty surgery types like thoracic surgery, cardiac surgery. Geneticists are frequently not going to be available outside of a major metropolitan area. The important thing I think that we always try to focus on, and I know is a concern for members as well as the general population, is access really to those kind of core providers that everyone needs, primary care providers, in some cases for women, OBGYN, and of course mental health providers.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Speaking of OBGYN, can you clarify the 30-mile radius? It says general hospital services. Would that include delivering babies, or do delivering babies fall under the 60-mile OBGYN?
Mr. Major, great question.
Madam Chair and Representative, so the 30-mile standard that applies to general hospital applies to a range of services that could be offered by a general hospital. In some cases, there may be services excluded, and I know in certain situations there are not obstetrics being offered in some hospitals. It's going to be the basics level of care that we should be expecting in a general hospital, but I definitely know that that is a concern, that obstetrics is not offered in all hospitals throughout the state. Just to clarify, OBGYN as a specialist provider is measured at a 60-mile standard.
Okay, I've got Representative Kunish-Padin, Loeffler, Grunhagen, and Munson. Representative Kunish-Padin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative touched on one of the questions that I had around maternity care. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask for that clarification of 30 to 60 miles, because we're hearing more and more about the services for childbirth not being available. One of the things you mentioned was that there were no waivers for Mille Lacs. Is that what you said?
Let me check my notes. I can.
Okay. That. And if it was that for? Does that mean that there should be maternity care available for childbirth in that area?
Mr. Major.
Madam Chair and Representative, so what we measure for the waivers are these 35 provider types, And it should mean that in Mille Lacs, there was no part of the county. Actually, I should point out an additional handout you got. There's a map in your materials, which that provides a geographic access map from one of our carriers. And I would also note that all our provider maps and our waivers are available online. There's a link in your presentation. But to answer your question, Representative, when we're measuring that access, we're looking at all parts of the county. And what that means is there is access in that county within 30 miles to a general hospital. I cannot say for certain whether that includes obstetrics.
Okay. And the reason I ask.
Senator Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. The reason I ask that is because I have a number of nieces up in the Mille Lacs Onamia area. And when they have, when they're having a child, they have to plan to go to St. Cloud over an hour away to have their babies born. And, you know, imagine driving through something like this in the throes of labor, or the complications of scheduling that birth and having to go in and be induced or end up with C-sections. And so I'm just wondering what your thoughts are around this whole issue about hospitals closing their birthing centers, and if there's anything that can be done for that.
Mr. Major.
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't think I'm in the best position to comment about the hospital decisions about what they're closing. That's not my area of expertise. Okay. What I can say is that carriers are required to cover all required services, and that includes obstetrics, and they need to provide reasonable access. So the insurance companies need to make sure that they've got a good mix of providers. Some of that includes obstetrics. In order to make sure that there's access for all their enrollees for all required care.
So, go ahead, Mr. Major. Sorry.
I think I should leave it at that.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So I've got Loeffler, Grunhagen, and Munson. Let me just say, members, I started out saying at the beginning, and I don't know if all of you were in the room at that time, this is obviously, while it sort of sounds like a dry technical discussion, it's really not, because we have, I'm sure every one of us probably has constituents that we could talk about the struggle to get access, even though they have coverage. And I just want us to, you know, knowing that those are very real, very critical issues to every member, to every Minnesotan. You know, having insurance means absolutely nothing if you don't have access to providers. So let's just put that on the table. I just want to say that because I want us to be able to talk about the, you know, we brought this forward so that members could understand what the law is around this and how it's being regulated. So if we could just kind of focus our comments on that aspect of it, not to in any way downplay the importance of the actual people getting the actual care. But this is, you know, this is the way hopefully we're going to learn how to impact that situation. So. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Major. I'm wondering if you could explain a little bit more, how do you measure the 30-minute access? You didn't talk about time, and that's a trickier thing to measure.
Mr. Major.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, I agree it's a trickier point to measure. Generally, our access if you look at that map that I provided as a sample, really looks at distance, and it truly is as the crow flies. And so what we are trying to find is where the gaps are. We are not at this point asking for the carriers or the plans to submit drive times, but we do that as part of our HMO application review.
Representative Block.
Madam Chair, a follow-up to that. That's really incredibly disappointing. And I totally understand the provider shortages in the other part of the state. But I represent 15 neighborhoods. Some of my neighborhoods, 20 to 25% of the people do not have one car in their household. They are totally transit dependent. And I just put into my phone, if someone on my block, which is only 6 miles max from downtown, I actually think it's 5, but I didn't measure that, to the largest outpatient clinic in downtown Minneapolis, and the best bus service in Minneapolis is to downtown, my constituent would have to transfer, and it would take them 1 hour to get to a 10 a.m. appointment on a Friday. So that's an hour to, an hour back, a transfer, and depending on how close they live to the bus stop, a 1 to 5 block walk in this kind of weather. And so I really would challenge you to start stepping up on meeting the requirement on time, particularly in the metropolitan area when we have so many people that are transit dependent and are service. I mean, this would actually probably be about the same numbers to get to the closest hospital as well.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to ask a question along the same line as Representative Loeffler, because I think we're having, looking at the numbers here, we're either applying metro standards to rural Minnesota or vice versa, because we may have farther miles to drive, but we can drive faster. So that was a very good point, and I think it would be better to have numbers that are more comparable. And I apologize for missing the beginning of the meeting, and if you covered this, but how much is the fee to apply for a waiver, if there's any? And is there any paperwork, if they are granted a waiver, that they have to submit and showing how they're going to come into compliance, whether in a year or two or three? And then of the 4,985 waivers that were approved for 2019, how many thousands of waivers were denied to these insurance companies? Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of running through questions here to see what you can answer. And then what impacts, if any, do these waivers have on insurance companies for other regulations or fines or fees or, you know, that we charge insurance companies to operate in the state who you deem, what is the term here, inadequate? So those are my questions. If you could answer one or any of
them. And thank you, Representative Munson. I think one of them might have been already answered, and that is how many there were, and it's in your packet. But other than that, Mr. Major, if you can try to tackle some of those, and we might need to. Did you write them down, or do you have them?
Madam Chair and Representative, I tried to keep track of,
okay.
I think, about four questions.
Okay.
So I will try to unpack them, and if I've missed something, please
okay.
let me know, and I'll
members,
be glad to answer.
We're going to move on quite soon to another presentation, so this will probably be the last question on this, unless there's something real burning issue. Mr. Major, go ahead, please.
Madam Chair and Representative, and I may not answer these in the exact order. I think you pointed at one point to differing standards in rural Minnesota and metropolitan Minnesota. Basically, it's one standard, and it's applying in both types of geographic areas, which, of course, are very different. The standard we have is a geographic access standard. We are challenged because you know, there are other ways that could be measured that would assess adequacy, that would account, for example, for how many providers are available for a given number of enrollees and timing and how long it takes to get an appointment. And I just want to note that the tool is fairly rough, and it's very easy to meet this standard in the metropolitan area. And it's comparatively much more difficult to meet it in rural Minnesota. And that's because we're applying a variety of provider types in those locations. You also wanted to know about waivers denied. And let me just unpack the process a little bit for you. So, that 4,985 waivers represents a specific waiver in a specific county for a given network. So with 44 networks, 87 counties, and 35 provider types, we get up to a range of possible waivers. So it's possible that, and I think it's reflected on the map, a county will be largely covered and will have fairly good access throughout, but there may be a corner of the county that's not covered, and that requires a waiver. And so there's a single waiver form that is submitted by the health plan or the carrier by network. And that covers all their waiver requests, all their provider types. The process that we go through is essentially to make sure that they are adequately explaining a couple things. I think of the waiver process as part of the who, what, why, how question. The who and the what are the providers, and we get that in a provider list, and we get locations on a map. And then what we want to know is the why and the how in that waiver process. Why exactly can you not, you, the carrier, cannot meet this standard? And essentially, how are you going to provide access? And how are you going to improve your access going over time? Ultimately, we are trying to get the waiver to a point where it fully explains the network and any access challenges that they have. You asked about fees, and the thing I would note about fees is there's not a specific fee for a waiver. There's a fee that's submitted by the health plan per binder. So, and not to go too deep into the weeds, but a health plan, when they're offering their set of plans and their provider networks, submits a binder which applies to either the individual or the small group market. And they pay a fee. I'm going to say it's pretty nominal, but there's not a fee per the waiver request. And then you asked about, is it fines? Is that correct? Did I have that question correctly?
I was just saying that if they have waivers, are they assessed fines for a waiver, or does it have any impact to how we regulate them, or is it just they just submit it?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative, so there wouldn't be a fine assessed for requesting a waiver that they're not fully compliant with statute, I guess I would say. What we continue to do is we request waivers every year, and we're monitoring these networks year in and year out, trying to get a sense of the way they're shaped, the way they develop. We continue to be asking questions about what kind of methods and steps we can take to get better information and make sure these networks are fully compliant and provide access and are adequate.
Okay, and I have one more from Representative Bierman, and then I would like to ask one myself, Representative Bierman.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Major. Representative Mann. I'll get to you next. Okay,
thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Major, the question I had is, in the Department of Health's regulating of the laws and the quality of care and the consumer rights, I'm sure you're going to tell me you don't regulate pricing at all, or are you involved in contracts?
Mr. Major.
Madam Chair and Representative, so the department does not get in the middle of negotiating contracts between providers and health plans. There's part of statute called the Health Plan Contracting Act. It's in Chapter 62Q, and I want to say it's 62Q735. Or starting around there. It's important for that health carriers are compliant with that part of law. But the department doesn't have a strong role in enforcing any of the provider contracting provisions there. The other terms, in terms of pricing, we're not involved with premium regulation. I'm not sure if that was part of your question as well.
Yep,
but we're not.
That's part of my question. And I'm wondering who does that exactly.
Mr. Major.
Madam Chair and Representative, so in the individual and small group market, premium rates are reported to the Department of Commerce and reviewed by the Department of Commerce, and we work collaboratively with them. So they review the premium rates for the health maintenance organizations that we regulate, and we review provider networks for their insurance companies.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted for us to be aware as a body that we do have a bit of a crisis on our hands when it comes to rural hospitals because of lower incomes and higher uninsurance rates. We have a higher level of uncompensated hospital care in the rural areas. And more rural hospitals are closing every year as compared to how many are opening. And we've had that trend now every year since 2011. So if we continue doing what we're doing or lack thereof, we're going to have a real big problem very, very soon.
Hey, thank you, Representative Mann. And I had a couple of questions, too, and just kind of quickly, because it says when you were showing us these slides, slide 7, it talks about the Affordable Care Act requires this that the plans offer provider networks sufficient in number and types of providers so that all services are accessible without unreasonable delay. And Minnesota law requires the networks provide sufficient number and types of providers to ensure covered services are available to all enrollees without unreasonable delay. Well, it does seem pretty clear to us from here at the legislature that those standards are not being met. And I'm really wondering how, given that we have this mileage and time standard, which obviously sometimes that's not being met either, you know, how would you, under these standards, ensure that enrollees are getting services without unreasonable delay? It seems to me that very often we hear about, yes, there are providers, but they don't have an appointment available, you know, even if they're theoretically in network. So how do you decide when you approve a network that indeed there are sufficient providers in that network so that people can be seen without unreasonable delay? Or, and this is kind of where I'm going, is the standard in law inadequate to make sure that our patients are actually seen? Mr. Majors.
Madam Chair and members, so the statements that you just read are really kind of the umbrella, both in the ACA and in Minnesota statute under Chapter 62K, broadly stating what the objectives of an adequate provider network are. The standards we have under 62K, as we've noted, are geographic access standards. The other points of measurement would be there are requirements for health plans to have, first of all, 24 hours, 7 days a week, emergency services available, primary care within certain time limits. I agree that there are challenges with not enough providers in networks and wait times. We need to find some better ways of measuring that. Regardless, carriers are required to basically provide access to services in a timely manner for healthcare services.
And finally, Mr. Major, if they don't, you know, what's the process here? And Representative Munson kind of got into this a little bit. You know, what happens if you deny? Say you deny a waiver. What then? What is the consequence? What teeth does any of this have for the department? Mr. Major.
Madam Chair and members, I think the challenge is making sure we've got networks throughout the state and that there's enough range of plans, and we're not there yet. We need a range of networks and at a range of price points. One of the problems that we come up against is we're balancing standards against that access. It would be possible to basically reject a network, and that's really the implication of fully denying the waiver. And that means that those qualified health plans cannot be offered.
Okay. Well, Mr. Major, thank you very much for your presentation. I wish we had more time to spend on this topic because obviously members are interested in it, and it impacts a lot of our constituents. My editorial comment here, my privilege as the chair, is just to say that the lack of adequacy of the providers, the fact that providers don't exist, is not a condition that, you know, falls from the sky. That this is something that the way we've set up our system, the way we pay for our system, all impacts where the providers are and who they're willing to see. And I just want us to think about that because, you know, it's not as though, If providers are telling us, if insurance systems, big systems are telling us, oh, we can't find a mental health provider, you know, one could say, you know, why aren't you using your resources to make sure that there is a provider? If you're selling a product that claims to provide care and the care isn't available, there is something very wrong. So thank you, Mr. Major. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Going to move on to if Ms. Peterman is here to talk to us about IHPs, integrated health partnerships. So members, we really are shifting gears now, and I hope Ms. Peterman can kind of give us a little structure so that we can get pulled back to what we're talking about here, because IHPs and even integrated health partnerships is probably pretty much Greek to a lot of us, so welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, for having me back to share with you about the Integrated Health Partnership Program. This is a continuation of the presentation we were doing last week about purchasing strategies at DHS. And this is an important, exciting one because it's an example where Minnesota's been able to be a leader in payment reform because of the collaboration with the legislature and many other stakeholders in DHS to implement this type of model in our Medicaid program. The IHP legislation really builds on our commitment to address rising costs in our healthcare system by shifting the financial incentive that we, instead of paying providers more to because they're doing more, instead we want to pay for value and good outcomes for people. This is done through a total cost of care approach so that providers can receive a share in the savings that they help create when they provide the right care for people. And they are also held accountable for cost and quality goals. When those are not met, they either pay those losses back or are held accountable for meeting those targets. So far, this model has had a positive impact. It's now in its sixth year, and integrated health partnerships together have achieved $277 million in savings compared to their projected cost targets. There are more than 450,000 Medicaid beneficiaries that get most of their care from an integrated health partnership. Integrated health partnerships have made service delivery changes, such as utilizing interdisciplinary care teams, community health workers or community paramedics, and other strategies like this to better support the Medicaid beneficiaries that they serve. As a result, we've seen utilization of the emergency room and hospitalizations decline, and meanwhile, the access to their primary care provider and office-based care has been maintained or increased slightly. Provider engagement in the integrated health partnership model has also remained high. There's been a lot of interest. There is a list of the current integrated health partnerships in the packet that was provided to you. And as you can see, integrated health partnerships are a variety of different provider types. They are integrated delivery service systems, independent practices, groups of different providers that come together to form an IHP. They exist all across Minnesota, including in Greater Minnesota, and together have hundreds of service locations and thousands of individual providers that are participating. We invite new integrated health partnerships in an annual RFP process, and we have added new participants each year. A couple of core concepts about an IHP's accountability. An important note is that financial incentive that I mentioned is aligned across their medical assistance population. So it includes both fee-for-service and medical assistance in Minnesota Care. So to be clear, providers are still paid according to the payment structures that we were talking about last week, either fee-for-service or based on the negotiated rate that they have with their managed care organization. And the shared savings incentive cuts across that by rewarding providers when that cost, based on that total cost of care, is met. So this incentivizes well-coordinated holistic care because the provider is accountable for a core set of services that a person receives regardless of where that care happens. So even if the care is not happening at their office at that day or at their system, it still is taken into account when we look at the overall experience for that person. DHS acts as a facilitative partner, providing detailed data analytic packages. And again, those are across their entire population so that they can see the medical assistance members that they're serving as a whole as well. Currently, accountability is determined for an IHP by looking back at where a person has received most of their care. So for a beneficiary, the IHP is really just synonymous with the care providers that they've been seeing. The providers have flexibility to use approaches that meet the needs of the population that they serve. This works well because they know the community resources that can best address those needs. So, for example, many of our integrated health partnerships have been working on addressing food insecurity when that is acting as a barrier for the people that they're serving. But their approach to addressing that is very tailored. Some will use, for example, local farmers to help address that. Some will use the food shelves or other tailored interventions that will make sense because of the resources that they have locally. We have recently made enhancements to the Integrated Health Partnership Program to really elevate this recognition of the important role that social determinants of health play in the overall wellness of a person. An example of this enhancement is the introduction of a population-based payment to the model. This allows providers to more confidently invest in those kinds of interventions and partnerships instead of relying just solely on the shared savings payment, which had some uncertainty and a retrospective nature about whether or not they'd be able to continue to use that to sustain the work that they've been doing in developing those community linkages and partnerships. We've also made it easier for providers, including community mental health and long-term care facilities, to receive timely notifications of facility admission, discharge, and transfer of care notifications through the implementation of a Minnesota Encounter Alert Service. These enhancements are tangible steps towards the IHP expansion that was articulated in the 2013 legislative authorization. We really appreciated the continued collaboration, again, with the feedback from people who are participating in the model, legislatures and others, but more work needs to be done, which is why we've been working towards a next-generation option. This would continue to have us improve the beneficiary experience by supporting their choices. The current IHP model, as I mentioned, uses kind of a retrospective way of linking accountability for cost and quality instead of honoring and strengthening the patient-provider relationship that happens when they enroll. We would like to make more of those care delivery dollars that are part of that aligned financial incentive payment that I mentioned. An example of how we could do this includes using a partial capitation payment that would, again, tie more of those dollars to an incentive that's based on value. Similar to the population-based payment, but that was a very modest increase compared to the overall financial picture for what a provider is accountable for. So, you know, compared to the population-based payment of $4.50, we'd like to see more of those aligned financial incentives made available to providers so that the dollars are closer to patient care and can be used on those patient-focused interventions. More conversations and stakeholder feedback is needed to continue the development of a next-generation model. DHS has done requests for comments and used many forums to gather that feedback, but will continue to do so over the next year. We also will continue to learn from the recent enhancements that were made to the IHP program. We recognize that it will take a lot of communication and time to work with all of the stakeholders that will be involved, which is why we anticipate and hope that we'll be able to have a request for proposals in 2020 for a potential next generation IHP contract in 2021. That is the presentation that I was going to finish up, and I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Peterman. And I don't know if you said for your name and your affiliation for the record. Would you just do that right now?
Yes, thank you. My name is Heather Peterman. I'm the Division Director in the Healthcare Research and Quality area of the Department of Human Services.
Okay, thank you. And I have a question for you, Ms. Peterman, and then I'm going to go to Representative Loeffler. So, first of all, I think this IHP whole thing is really confusing. And one of the reasons it's really confusing is that because it operates both inside and outside of managed care. So help me understand this. When it's inside managed care, we're paying a capitated rate to managed care organizations. And then supposing that patient, that person is now going to be part of an IHP. How does that money work? Because let me just say, too, before you answer, this idea of doing a capitated rate and then having them manage the care to get the best result and keep costs down, that was the whole point, I thought, of having managed care in the first place. Mm-hmm. So please explain how we have this other layer inside this top layer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. So the way that the IHP operates amongst the other purchasing strategies is that there is a component in the managed care contract that has them partner with us in this program. The total cost of care savings, shared savings payment, looks at both the fee-for-service payments and the payments that were made through the managed care in order to determine whether or not we've seen the overall cost and utilization for the population that the provider is seeing go down. And if it has, then the managed care organization with us pays a portion of that savings back to the IHP. So it really layers over top what the fee-for-service or managed care organizations are already paying, helping to align those financial incentives for the provider.
So, Ms. Peterman, are you telling me that then, say that patient is on managed care, they're in an IHP, there's some additional savings, we need to give an incentive to that provider for those additional savings, and there's additional money that comes in to pay that, or is that part of the capitated, or did I just misunderstand this completely?
Thank you for clarifying. It is not additional money. It's the dollars that would have been paid out because we anticipated a level of care. It was paid to the managed care organization in a capitation payment or projected for us to pay as fee for service. And so a portion of that is paid back to the provider as the shared savings. So it's not new dollars that are paid to the provider.
So, Ms. Peterman, it is a portion of that capitated payment, so they get an additional amount of money from the managed care organization and not another chunk from directly from the Minnesota taxpayer or the federal taxpayer.
Correct. The shared savings is a portion of that, and it's combined a combined payment of the for how many of their people were on managed care and how many were on fee for service. The shared savings is the share for them of what was saved from those existing payments.
Okay, thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Peterman, it's maybe a decision made above your pay grade. But I have a concern about roles. We get elected as policymakers to oversee and assigned to this committee to oversee the whole health and human services budget. And the biggest part of our budget is providing health care to these populations. And on page one, you know, you have the authority, which is to create a demonstration project 6 years ago. To me, a demonstration project is a pilot in a limited geographic area with some definition of what the goals are that you can be held accountable to in terms of whether you achieved them or not, and you come back with a report that says we should expand this model to other places or not, and then you know you got authority to expand it, but absolutely no description of the bones of it. And here you have people like Chair Liebling, who have been on this committee for 12 or more years, know this system, and we still do have no clue about exactly how this works, how much the providers benefit, how much the patients benefit, how much the administrative costs are much more complicated, and you're now proposing that you're going to, with stakeholders, which I assume means the people who get the money as opposed to the policymakers, the stakeholders are going to get together with you, and you're going to take their input and their suggestions. And in 2020, before we even act again, you're going to offer a whole new version of this to totally change the healthcare delivery system for the people for whom the state provides resources and wants to assure that they get quality care at a fair price. And I'm concerned
that well, even though this may be a wonderful model, and I've heard really wonderful, successful stories from some IHPs, that we as policymakers have not been seen as stakeholders and partners in designing the system. And so if you're going to go forward with a new version of this with an RFP in 2020, I would hope that you would bring us some language so that we can give some policy guidance and establish some outcomes by which we can tell the taxpayers we represent if it's been a good deal or not, or where we need to tweak it, which is more of a comment. Like I say, I think the decisions were made above your pay scale, probably. But and if others share that thought, I'd appreciate, you know, them sharing that with DHS as well. But I do think this is our biggest budget account, and we really should understand where it's evolving to and what the outcomes are.
Ms. Peterman, did you want to respond? You don't have to.
Representative Laughlin. Actually, I really appreciate the concern. I maybe would just respond by saying I think that's partly why laying out where we have had the interaction with the legislature to help support this program and why it has expanded is because we started with that first objective of let's help keep the cost of health care down by trying this type of incentive. We saw that it was working, so we wanted to, you know, continue to support it and expand it. That continues to be the case, which is why we are where we are, where we're saying, okay, what's been working? What are some of the places where we think that this incentive can be even stronger to help us continue the work that we've been seeing?
Thank you. Actually, thank you, Representative Laffer. I had that written down as another one of my questions, kind of where you went with it, so I'm glad you did. And just to remind everybody, just from the slide here, slide 12, people serve 460,000 plus. So remember, in our Medicaid program, we're serving about 1.1 million people. So that's, you know, a good chunk of the people that we're serving in our public programs are in this IHP model. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 12, the current impact of IHPs, has DHS undertaken an independent audit, like a third-party audit, to verify the savings that the IHP claims that they have had?
Ms. Peterman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, we have not had an independent audit, so to speak, of that. We do use an actuary to help with some of the shared savings calculations that supports the model. When we did the statewide innovation model grant a couple years ago, we also had included in that an evaluation that was done by the University of Minnesota and some dollars to support having a separate data analytic vendor help do some analysis. So we certainly have had lots of people help us verify, you know, the savings that we've been looking at. If your question was also more about, you know, what the providers are saying, we use the information that's reported through encounters and claims as well as the financial reports and also the quality measures that they submit through the statewide quality reporting measurement system or that we can calculate from the claims and encounters. So those are examples of ways that we've concluded the success of the model.
Okay, I have a couple more questions.
Well, Representative Franson, so we have Schumacher, Grunhagen, Bierman, Moran, and we're going to maybe go five more minutes on this topic. So go ahead.
So if the providers can share the upside risk with an IHP, will they also be held at risk of sharing any losses? And what happens if that utilization is higher and costs are higher than expected? Will the providers be at risk of having to pay money back to the IHP or DHS if there is a financial loss?
Ms. Peterman.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is a correct understanding. The providers, if they are, depending on the track that they're in, again, the kind of the size and how capitalized they could be to take on downside losses, they would be at risk to pay back to DHS if they exceed the target. Others may not have that downside loss, and so then they are not eligible for the shared savings if they aren't able to achieve the target.
Representative Franson. Okay. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Peterman, I just wanted to take a moment to kind of just juxtapose the two conversations, the presentations that we've had today, and what's going on with the IHPs and the idea of network adequacy, and just kind of what, for the philosophy on the IHP side, what is it for the provider adequacy and making sure that all services are covered within that? How is that approached?
Ms. Peterman.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. I think similar to the question about how does the payment work, it's really important to remember that the IHP model is kind of sitting across the existing structure, so it doesn't really change any of or impact any of what you heard about network adequacy. It's really about aligning that financial incentive that the provider has for the care delivery that they're delivering. So there isn't, you know, a component of them having to, you know, formally define, you know, a network or access or something like that. So I hope that helps answer your question.
Thank you.
And members, I apologize. I said before we were only going to go another 5 minutes, but our next presenter is not here yet, so we're going to go until they get here. So Representative Franson, I was shut you down a little bit, but if you want to go back on the list, I'd be happy to put you on. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Ms. Petersburg, thanks for your presentation. You know, I talked to a few medical people about this, and their characterization was that really it's, you know, with the global budget needing to stay under that in order to get shared revenue out of it, it's bedside rationing of health care. In other words, the doctor's going to have pressure, especially if the budget is out of whack as the year goes along, to have less care, even if it's needed. It takes away, because they want to stay under that global budget in order to get shared savings at the end of the year. So to a certain degree, it's health care rationing through a capitated rate. That was their characterization. Can you modify that in any way? And again, this was a medical doctor who has just retired recently who gave me that characterization.
Ms. Peterman?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would like to modify that because we don't have a global budget. That total cost of care that I mentioned is a risk-adjusted target based on what we would expect. It doesn't apply to any individual member. There's also a check and balance against that loss of, you know, inappropriate use of services by the quality measures. So a provider would not be able to be rewarded for simply, you know, not providing the care because then they would not meet their quality targets. There's a check and balance it against that. We think that providers want to provide good care to members, and so this is really a way to make sure that the incentive supports them doing that holistic approach to care.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just an observation. Again, I've sold health insurance since 1978. I'm not a fast learner, but, you know, if you do something for 40 years, you begin to understand what's going on. You know, we're just transferring more and more of the medical decisions, you know, whether it's pre-authorization, this or whatever, to a nameless, faceless bureaucracy that doesn't really meet with the patient. And the doctor's almost like a puppet in that room. And I don't think as we go forward that's a very good model for delivering health care to our citizens. I think we need to look outside the box of what has been proposed to see if we can get better access and better care. Thank you.
Ms. Peterman, are we transferring medical decisions to a nameless, faceless bureaucracy here?
Madam Chair, no, we're not. Thank you, Representative, for that comment, because I would agree, which is why you heard in my presentation, one of the things that we think is really helpful is that this moves the dollars closer to that patient-provider relationship, and it allows the flexibility for the provider to establish those, you know, care connection points and to provide the care that they want to for a patient without worrying about, you know, I get paid this way if I do it fee-for-service, et cetera. So we agree that's one of the core components of this model.
We'll agree to disagree.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, thank you for admitting some confusion on your part about this whole thing, because I've been at this a few weeks, and this whole presentation just kind of was over the top for me. So I just wanted to say thank you for that, but I also wanted to say thank you for Representative Loeffler for her comments about the way this system works, and Rep. Grunhagen as well, that it's you know, whether it's a bureaucrat or a government official, we need to move them both out and get patient and doctor together and make sure that our health care is being taken care of by those two entities rather than bureaucrats. And you know, I've been at this just a few weeks, and I've heard of this integrated health plan, and I was intrigued and interested by it, but I have the same questions that Rep. Loeffler had about oversight and our role in that, and I think we can't really have oversight unless we know what other measures are being considered for cost savings, what those are, how they're developed. I know Ms. Peterson did say hospital intakes were down. That's an obvious system savings. But one of my biggest concerns with the whole conversation was this whole fee-for-service and incentivized care and putting the whole impetus on money that is going to be earned back by the provider for value. And in my business, value, unfortunately, usually means cheaper. So I'm troubled by that kind of what maybe just in my mind, but I have major concerns that if we're trying to create value and incentives for the health insurance companies to save money and make more from their capitated contracts, we may be headed in the wrong direction.
Thank you. Representative Moran, you have the final question here, and then Mr. Brickwetty is here to give us the next presentation. Please go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. A little confusing for me, too. So I think it's always great to see savings, right? So we have $277 million in savings. But before I go on, just so I can, like, explain what I think I heard you say, are the IHPs the providers? That's my first question.
Ms. Peterman?
Yes.
Okay.
IHPs are made up of a collection of providers.
Representative Moran.
So we have savings here, $277 million, but the savings are used to give the providers the incentives to do the innovative care delivery or care coordinations. So, in reality, what are the real savings, and who is saving? I mean, what do those savings look like? Because the savings are going back to the providers. So what are we really saving, or is there a savings?
Ms. Peterman.
Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. So the savings is compared to what we would have expected if we look at a similar mix of people and what their utilization and costs look like. If we take what we expect to spend and we see what actually happens, that is what we're calling the savings. And by having it shared back with the providers to help support the interventions and innovations that they're doing to provide good care, it makes sure that they're not, that they can continue those efforts and not just focus on the visit at hand and just getting paid for that transaction, but thinking of the things like I mentioned of how to better connect someone to the things that might be impacting their ability to stay well, following up with their behavioral health provider so that care can be well coordinated, you know, those sorts of things.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
So I do. I really appreciate coordinated care. I really do appreciate prevention and trying to move upstream so that people are more healthy, so that cuts down the hospital visits and the hospital stays. I appreciate that. But it's not really a savings, because then we're giving it back
because you're saying this is what we would have spent anyway. But because you're doing a good job of cutting, of coordinating services and cutting down the visits, we're going to give you this money anyway to keep that type of incentive going on, right? So, you know, I can appreciate, right, you saying it's a savings. I can appreciate the coordinated efforts, but it's, we're not, as a state, our state dollars, we're not really saving anything because it's been given back to the providers anyway for their, the work that they should do anyway, because we should be looking at it through that lens. For some reason, they're not doing it, right? But we're giving them extra dollars to do what they should be doing.
Ms. Peterman, just real briefly, because we need to move on, and Representative Haley has a real quick question, please.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the comment. I think maybe I would just connect this back to the other pieces that we talked about last week, where in this instance, since we are talking about both fee-for-service and managed care, they are dollars that would have gone out and that contribute to us continuing to trend higher and higher in our spend in healthcare. So by starting to say, you know, we want to spend dollars the right way, that is how it's helping us save dollars, is because the cost of healthcare is lower for us.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Peterman. Representative Haley.
Thank you for indulging me, Chair Liebling. And just because I guess I have a counter position, I thought it might be worthwhile to offer it. In serving on a hospital board and working with physicians, that you hear the frustration of you know, having to treat patients like a widget, like I need to see so many a day, and yet a patient comes in and has diabetes and is having trouble quitting smoking and has all these other issues. So I see this IHP as an innovation project, and we always take some risk when you're trying to innovate. But I think we need to focus on the value of the care coordination that the physicians are being incented to do and the systems are being incented to do, and that is helping provide better patient care. And in my opinion, in an innovation-type project, there is incentive up front. We are seeing the savings, and now we need to look at how do we take that innovative model and make it a best practice and then align the payments so this is just now the new way of how we do business. So I've seen it beneficial in arenas I've worked in.
Thank you, Representative Haley. All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Peterman, for being here on the firing line for a while, and appreciate that. And let's bring up Peter Brickwitty from the Department of Commerce.
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. Thank you for having me, and my apologies to you and the committee for arriving a little bit later than I had hoped. It's like a four times the regular amount of time it takes me to make the three-minute drive from my office in downtown Minneapolis.
It's not snowing or anything, is it?
For the first time, Madam Chair, I cannot see the building across the street from me outside my office window. So, Madam Chair, my presentation will be relatively short. The committee had asked if we could provide a brief, high-level overview of some of the state-based market stability mechanisms historically used in Minnesota. So I think the page is distributing my short presentation to members now, but I'm going to be talking about three mechanisms that the state has employed previously. I'm going to be talking about MCHA in its previous capacity as the state's high-risk pool. I'm going to talk very briefly about the premium subsidy program that was put in place by the legislature and Governor Dayton in 2017, and then the Minnesota Premium Security Plan, which is the state's reinsurance program currently operating here. I'm not going to be touching on the federal risk stabilization programs, commonly known as the three R's, of which there were risk adjustment, risk corridors, and reinsurance. Happy to talk with members offline if you have questions about those.
And Mr. Brickwitty, just before you get started here, just on your very first slide, or your, actually, maybe the second slide, when you talk about stability tools, the historic MCHA, I didn't think of that as a stability tool. That was a program that was there for people who couldn't get insurance because at that, maybe you're going to cover this, but I guess I'm just taking a little issue with putting that in as a stability tool, because I didn't view it that way. But maybe you can address that.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to, and thank you for that clarification. And I would agree with you. I think the purpose of MCHA when it was established in 1976 was to provide an access point for individuals in Minnesota who could not otherwise obtain coverage. I think conceptually, high-risk pools are a state-based strategy that states, particularly in that era in the late 70s and into the 80s, employed as a mechanism by which to, in effect, subsidize their individual markets. And I actually included a slide from Mr. Gildemeister's presentation last week to the committee that I think highlights that point very clearly. So, Madam Chair, as I mentioned, MCHA was originally established by the legislature in 1976 and began operating in 1977. It was one of the oldest and largest high-risk pools operating in the country. And individuals were able to get into MCHA by virtue of being denied coverage in the individual market, almost exclusively for pre-existing conditions. Premiums for those individuals were set by statute to be higher than they would have been had those individuals been able to access coverage in the individual market. They were set between 101 and 125% of the standard premium rate. And the program itself was funded through a combination of those enrollee premiums and then annual assessments. That assessment amount varied. I put a couple of examples so that members could have a sense of what the growth looked like over the course of the program. 2013 was the last year that the assessment was made. It was the last full year of MCHA's operation in its existence as a high-risk pool. There were also two other situations, Madam Chair, where the legislature appropriated dollars to the program directly. And, Madam Chair, as I mentioned just a moment ago, I included this slide from Mr. Gildemeister's presentation, which I think highlights very clearly what the costs were and would be if MCHA was still operating as a high-risk pool, not only for the enrollees, but for the small businesses that are that absorb the cost of that assessment. So what you have in front of you in that chart is the blue boxes in each one of the columns is the personal responsibility cost of the premium for those members. And employer-sponsored coverage and the individual no subsidy and an individual subsidy are based on actual data for 2018. The column on the right is a projection that the Health Economics Program did of what MCHA premiums would cost today, and as you can see, the individual member's contribution is higher than it would be in the individual market today. But I think important context to note that the green section, which is the amount that's actually passed on through the assessment, is significantly larger than any of the other contributions that are made not by the person who's being insured. Madam Chair, moving to the premium subsidy program, I'll touch on this very quickly. As legislators know, in 2017, the state established a program that provided a 25% discount to Minnesotans who were not otherwise eligible for premium assistance. That was done in the first 2 weeks of the legislative session. There was an appropriation of $312 million for that purpose. The program was administered by health insurers on an individual basis and then was run out of MMB for the state, so Commerce was not involved in the administration of the program. Ultimately, the program spent about $137 million and served approximately 118,000 Minnesotans. The program's operations were audited by the OLA last year, and I refer members and encourage you to read that report if you are interested in more details. And then, Madam Chair, moving on to the premium security plan, and these slides were part of a presentation that Commissioner Kelly gave last week in Chair Halverson's committee, and so this may be familiar for members who saw that. But following the passage of the premium subsidy program, then the legislature established the premium security plan, or the state's reinsurance program. The state appropriated $271 million in 2018, as well as $271 million in 2019. The federal government, and actually, perhaps I'll back up just a moment, Madam Chair. The program operates under a federally issued waiver called a 1332 waiver, which the state had to apply for and was approved by the federal government in 2017. Under the terms of that waiver, the state receives funding that would have otherwise flowed to the state in the form of advanced premium tax credits for purposes of helping to fund the reinsurance program. So my note there that the federal government provided $131 million in 2018, that is the actual amount that was sent to the state for operations in the program in 2018. And under the state law, federal dollars are required to be expended first. So a federal dollar received is a state dollar unspent for the program. The maximum amount that the reinsurance program can spend in both plan year 2018 and in 2019 is $271 million. So the state share of the program for 2018 would be capped at approximately $140 million. We do not yet know what the final costs of the program will be for 2018, and I'll talk more about the schedule for when we will know in just a moment. A couple of other quick notes about the operations of the program. It is administered by MCHA, now in its new capacity as the administrator of the reinsurance program, no longer operating a high-risk pool. The Commerce Department serves as the fiscal agent for both the state and the federal government, the dollars that are appropriated. And the statutory parameters that were set in 2018 and then approved again by the board in 2019, the board of MCHA, were an attachment point of $50,000. So that is the point at which the reinsurance program starts to provide reimbursement to an insurance company for a claim that has hit $50,000. It then pays 80% of that claim up to $250,000. So within that corridor between $50,000 and $250,000, 80% of those costs are covered. Madam Chair, I would note, too, that there is an impact from a state budgeting standpoint to the basic health plan funding mechanism that was due to a decision by the federal government in its analysis of our 1332 waiver. The BHP impact for 2018 is estimated to be about $90.5 million in reduced federal funding due to the lower market rates that result from the reinsurance program.
And Mr. Brickwedy, that's not on the slide any place, is it?
No, Madam Chair. Okay. No. And I would defer to my colleagues from the Department of Human Services if you'd like to discuss that impact in more detail.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, turning to page 7, the most recent data that we have from MCHA is quarter 3 data, so this is through the third quarter of 2018. The amount is estimated to be $84.1 million, as you see there. 58% of the claims that were in that make up that dollar amount were from Rating Area 8, the Twin Cities metro area, 11% from the Rochester area, and then smaller amounts from across the rest of the state. We do expect a fairly significant change in that number, that $84.1 million number, because many claims do not hit that corridor until later in the year, and we would expect there to be an initial estimate coming relatively shortly here, perhaps as early as next week, of what the quarter four number would be without claims run out for the rest of the year. Turning to slide 8, we expect that information because plans were required to report it to MCHA by January 22nd. We would hope that that information, again, we may have as early as next week, so it can be incorporated into the February forecast so that it can inform policymakers' decisions going forward. End of year 2018 data is going to be collected and validated beginning in the second quarter of 2019. Year-end reporting is expected in June of 2019, and payments to individual market carriers will be made in one lump sum no later than August 15th of 2019 for calendar year 2018 claims. Madam Chair, realizing I was trying to move very quickly, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Yeah, thank you. We're almost out of time here. We just have a couple questions. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I actually had to miss your presentation because I was presenting another bill, so good to hear it in this committee. With regard to MSHA, I know, Madam Chair, that you and Mr. Brickwedy said it's not a market stabilization tool per se, but that was the essential effect in terms of the individual market in Minnesota. It was something that kept premiums predictable and stable in the individual market because the individual market pool was quite healthy. So I just wanted to make that point that that was the practical approach. I am curious in terms of the number of people served by MSHA, because my brain is failing me, and you can get this to me later, with regard to those 2012 and 2013 dollars spent. I'm curious how many enrollees were affected by that.
Madam Chair, Representative Halverson, at its peak, I think MSHA served about 29,000 people in on an annual basis. I believe at the end in 2013, it was approximately 24, but I can double-check that number and confirm it.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Schultz.
I just have a clarifying question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's not any individual claim that's between 250 and 250 attachment points. You're saying that if it's cumulative in the year, once the individual's total claims go over 50, we start paying 80%?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I believe it's the former. So an individual claim that itself would accrue between $50,000 and $250,000 worth of cost, that the program would pay 80% of that amount. So it can hit $50,000 in one procedure, or that claim can accrue that amount throughout the course of the year.
Okay, that was my understanding,
Representative
too,
Schultz.
Was that it was the former, not the latter. But we'll talk offline about your comment, and your bullet in the slide deck, because I don't understand why the fourth quarter, but we'll talk offline.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Schultz. That's a really good question. I just want to say another word about this stabilization issue. You know, I just want people to remember, before the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies could reject people for insurance if they had pre-existing conditions, and they did it a lot. The MSHA pool was there to give those people an opportunity to get insurance, but it wasn't stabilizing the market. I mean, maybe it's a matter of semantics. I would argue what was stabilizing the market, so-called, is that the insurance companies didn't have to cover high-cost people. They were controlling their costs by kicking out or refusing coverage to people that they believed would cost a lot of money. Under the ACA, of course, they're not allowed to do that. So those people have to be allowed into the market. Hence the perhaps necessity of market stabilization. That also is kind of arguable. But anyway, I just wanted to make that distinction. The fact that we had a high-risk pool was because people could be kicked out of the market and be unable to purchase insurance at any price. And so we had a way for them to purchase insurance, even though it was, by definition, at a higher cost to them than market insurance, and it was heavily subsidized. But important to realize, because I know people like to look back at MSHA with kind of rose-colored glasses, many people could not afford the cost of premiums under MSHA because they were higher than market. So if you were not able to afford those higher than market premiums, and you did not qualify for public programs, which was much harder to do then, you were simply uninsured. So that was kind of the, if people want to remember what the problem was before the ACA came in, and I don't want to start an argument about how perfect or unperfect that was, but there was a reason. This was not solving the problem of uninsurance in Minnesota. So with that, members, thank you very much, Mr. Brickwitty, and I'm sure he would be happy to talk with you offline. We are adjourned.